gracewalkbiblechurch.com, and here's the lesson from last week, Codex Sinaiticus Research, What Color is the Parchment? So I'm going to go ahead and click on that, and then up here is a listing of the different series that this is a part of. So I'm going to click on A Tale of Two Constantines, Rethinking Codex Sinaiticus. And going all the way back to the summer of 2017, I read some books and I taught six parts on A Tale of Two Constantines, Rethinking Codex Sinaiticus. And then I was asked to teach in April 2018 at the Bible Conference in Chicago to the pastors, and I did a two-part thing on Codex Sinaiticus or Codex Simonides, understanding how the text of the Reformation was undermined. And then, late that year, as I tried to explain last week, four documents were put in front of me by Dave Reed, kind of calling into question the validity of some of the books that I had been reading on some of this research. And so I pumped the brakes on this for all of 2019, all of 2020, and really the first half of this year, 2021. And what got me thinking about this again was the July release last month of this book, Who Faked the World's Oldest Bible, The Evidence Reveals a Much Larger Plot by David W. Daniels. So this is the sequel to the book that was released in January 2018, Is the World's Oldest Bible a Fake? So, and then before that, in 2016, was by Bill Cooper, The Forging of Codex Sinaiticus. And then in between, I didn't bring it this week, was the 2017 book by David Sorensen on Neither Oldest Nor Best. Okay, so we went through all that information back then, and then I pumped the brakes on that information, and I actually went through the church's YouTube page and the church's website, and I marked all this stuff as private, so it was no longer visible to the public, because I just wasn't sure anymore, and I wanted some time to kind of think through things and see how things developed, right? So, the four things that were given to me in December 2018, the first one was a review of The Forging of Codex Sinaiticus by Dr. William Cooper, all right? And this was by a guy named Kevin McGrain. So that was a review, and that was published in 2018. So that was a review of this book right here. Okay? So that was handed to me. Two other things were handed to me. The next one was an unpublished book review by Elijah Hickson on Is the World's Oldest Bible a Fake? And then also handed to me was another thing by Hickson, new evidence on the question of whether or not Codex Sinaiticus is a 19th century fake. And then also by Kevin McGrain that we went through last Sunday was this one right here, Is David W. Daniels' Codex Sinaiticus Evidence a Fake? And so I read enough things in these four reviews to really give me significant pause as to whether or not some of the things that I had said were true or not. Okay? So the reason I'm bringing this up again now is because of the publication of Who Faked the World's Oldest Bible by Daniels last month. Now, let me say a couple things as we get started. First thing I want to say is, I don't care whether or not Codex Sinaiticus is 100 years old or 1,500 years old. It doesn't matter to me because I do not accept it as bearing the marks of preservation. So it doesn't matter to me if it's a 4th century document or if it's a 19th century document. I don't accept it as a viable witness to the preservation of the New Testament text. Okay? So let me just say that again. Second, I went back through and I reviewed some things, because remember we had the images of Daniel holding the clipboards and he was covering the color strips last week, and I do not think, and I want to be clear about this, I do not think that that was intentional. There are other videos where he's holding the things up where you can clearly see the color strips, okay? So I do not think that that was some sort of an intentional subterfuge by the part of Brother Daniels. Okay. The third thing I want to say is, while I appreciate Brother Daniels, I have had personal correspondence with him on a variety of different things over the years, and have always enjoyed my conversations and stuff with him. But that said, I'm finding myself more and more at odds and unconvinced by the things that he's argued in his books, okay? And that, of course, is probably going to put me at odds with some other people who agree with him, who are totally buying into this idea that the Codex is a 19th century forgery, all right? For me, as I've evaluated evidence, it's hard for me to maintain that position, okay? And I will also say that the four reviews I just showed you, just hold it up and showed the camera and showed all of you that are in the room right now, none of the information that is presented in those four reviews is even addressed in the July 2021 publication of Who Faked the World's Oldest Bible, which for me is somewhat disappointing, because I was hoping that if there was a answer to some of the stuff, that it would be addressed if more further books were written, etc. And it, as far as I could tell, it has not been. And not only has it not been, it seems to me that a lot of the things that we're going to look at today have been sort of completely ignored and not even addressed. Okay, so I'm just telling you where I'm at with this. Right, it doesn't matter to me if it's old or if it's new. I don't accept it as a viable witness to the text, and I never have, even before April 2017, when I started reading David Sorensen's book, which is what got all this started for me. Okay. Now, all that said, last Sunday what we were looking at was the question of what color is the parchment? All right, because a lot of the argumentation that it's a 19th century forgery is swirling around the color of the parchment, right? So this is the cover of Is the World's Oldest Bible a Fake? And there's a collage on the cover of all of the different leaves in Codex Sinaiticus, okay? 42 leaves were taken by Tischendorf in 1943 and brought to Germany, Leipzig, Germany, and presented as a gift to Prince Frederick of Saxony, and it was called the CFA Codex Frederico Augustans. They are a lighter color on this collage, right? I showed you in the video last Sunday by putting it on the board or the screen. I don't want to do that because I want to move on to some other stuff, okay? But then the remaining 315 leaves that were uncovered by Tischendorf in 1859 and brought to St. Petersburg originally now are in the possession of the British Library. They were what appears to have been on this collage a darker yellow stain color. And then, of course, a lot of the argumentation for why the Codex is a 19th century forgery is related to those types of color things, okay? Now, that's about all I want to say right now in review. So I know some of you are maybe real new to this and you're like, what's going on? Hopefully you can get at least something out of this as I update sort of everybody on where things are at. Now, during the about 2.5 years that I had sort of marked all this stuff private and it was not available, people were like writing to me and saying, well, what happened to your Codex Sinaiticus stuff? And I would say, I'm undecided about that. I'm not sure anymore about some of that stuff, okay? Now, I want to follow up on one point from last week related to the color, okay? So, I'm going to load the PowerPoint presentation that I used in April of 2020, and I want to just show you again a little bit. So here's the issue, right? These 43 leaves that are in Leipzig, I said 1843 a minute ago, it was 1844, Tischendorf takes these back and they appear to be a different color from the remaining 315 leaves that made it to St. Petersburg in 1859, right? And so then this has created all kinds of speculation about who darkened these 315 sheets to make them appear older, and all sorts of things have been said about that, and I reviewed that with you last time, okay? And then we went through McGrain's article, where he talks about the color strips on the Codex Sinaiticus website, there's discrepancies. So there you see you can kind of see these sheets are darker, these sheets are lighter. And here's a Kodak sort of color strip. And we went through all this last time about, and there's, you know, the images. I don't think that he's doing this on purpose. There's plenty of other images where he's holding up pictures and he's not covering the color strip. So to me, that's not even something I'm willing to entertain. But we looked at all of this data last time, comparing the different leaves and the different colors, right? So this is the reference Bart asked about. So here's the Kodak color strip reference in the middle. This is the coloration as it shows up on the Leipzig, the 43 leaves that are in Leipzig, Germany, versus the ones, the 315 that are in currently in the British Museum in London. And you can see that they are not exact color matches, right? So the reason why, according to McGrain, the 43 leaves on the Codex Sinaiticus website, the images that Daniels used to make this collage on the cover of his book appear lighter than the others is because they were not taken under the same color standards, okay? The same color and so forth, okay? Now, again, I could go on and on about that. I don't want to. I want to get to something a little bit new about this that we haven't talked about yet. So I'm reading now from McGrain's review, page 117, and this is a follow-up point about the color. He says, it's clear from these extracts that the usage of paleographers, collectors, and curators white in describing, It is clear that these extracts that in the usage of paleographers, collectors, and curators, white is a distinguishing term for a type or kind of parchment, not a reference to its presented look and condition. Just as, for example, we properly describe a statue as being sculpted in, quote, white marble, even now appearing gray due to the effects of pollution. So some ancient sculptor sculpts out of white marble, you know, 5,000 years ago, just being random here, okay, and you look at it now, is it going to look weathered and yellow and not as, you know, crisp and all that sort of thing, right? Well, that's what McGrain's saying here. Then he goes on to say, parchment was commonly produced in three color grades in the ancient times. White, yellow, and purple. Okay? White, yellow, and purple. So, when they describe this as snow white, they're describing not necessarily the way the page appears, but the type of the parchment that is being used. Okay? So parchment was commonly produced in three color grades in ancient times, white, yellow, and purple. The white represented unstained natural color and could be somewhat yellow. The yellow and purple parchment were intentionally stained. Obviously yellow or purple, okay? Scriptures were generally written on unstained white parchment using black, brown, and red inks, occasionally gold ink. Now, there is an example that we can look at. There is this codex right here. This is a witness to the Gothic New Testament, okay? Codex Argententius, I guess is how you would say that, unless somebody has a better pronunciation. But look at what the description of this here says. It says, splendid manuscript written in silver and gold ink on purple parchment. You can see what color is the parchment. Purple, right? So when they're saying white parchment, McGrain's argument is when they're saying white parchment, they're talking about the type of parchment, okay, versus purple parchment, which is clearly stained what? Purple and written on with gold and silver ink. So I have an enhanced picture of this, and there are a bunch of different pictures on the internet of this particular manuscript, and you can see that it definitely was stained what? Purple. So this would have been a different type of manuscript from the ancient world. So you would have had white parchment, you would have had yellow parchment, you would have had purple parchment. This is an example of that, right? So what McGrain is saying then is that the arguments based upon color are not proving what the users of those arguments are believing them to be proving. I'm going to go to page 118 of McGrain's rebuttal, and he says, clearly, Dr. Cooper has greatly misunderstood the meaning of, quote, white parchment, believing it to be a description of the present observed color, i.e. the attribute of whiteness, rather than the unstained parchment distinct from color-stained varieties. Does everybody understand the difference, right? This is clearly a stained what?
Parchment.
Okay? But in common with many others, thus the reader is seriously led astray by his inferences. But in common with many others, Dr. Cooper has not only mistaken a type for an attribute, but also has mistakenly called as witnesses to the leaves in Leipzig, recovered by Tischendorf in 1844, persons who were classifying the yellow-looking leaves then in St. Petersburg that were recovered in 1859. From this twin error, Dr. Cooper infers that the portion of the codex in the British Library has been deliberately distressed and discolored to give it an appearance of age since 1845-1850. Dr. Cooper does not consider whether the leaves in St. Petersburg, London, and Sinai are yellow simply because that is what white parchment looks like after the natural process of what? Of aging. Is everybody following what I'm saying here? Okay, and then let's go to page 123 of what McGrane says. So leaving aside the Leipzig leaves, so again, what are we talking about there? I'm talking about the differences in color here. Leaving aside the Leipzig leaves, we have observations of the codex and fragments thereof in 1845, 1850, and 1861 by Uspensky, and have extant parts of the codex taken by Uspensky in 1845 and 1861, and by Tischendorf in 1853 and 1859. Additionally, we have colored plates of Genesis 24 and 1 Corinthians 13 based upon Uspensky's 1845 and 1850 observations, printed in 1857, and a colored plate of the numbers fragment taken by Uspensky to Russia in 1861 and printed in England in 1866. These are all yellowish, and some are very close match in color to the leaves in Leipzig. Finally, we have leaves recovered in 1975, which lain in dreadful condition since the 1830s, and are slightly browner due to accelerated aging, and the fragment discovered by Sarsius in 2009 that had been bound into a book in 1727. It is quite impossible to fit a process of deliberate discoloration into the time scale from 1845 onwards. The evidence leads directly to the conclusion that the leaves and the ink of the codex are authentic colors for old writing on an old parchment. Okay? Now, really quick, does anybody have any questions about that? I know some of you weren't here when we were originally looking at some of this, so you might be kind of wondering what I'm talking about here, but hopefully it's at least somewhat clear. Anybody have any quick questions before we move on to the next point I want to make?
I've got a question about the codex coloring. It sounded like you were saying the difference in that codex scale might have been because of the lighting that was put on the parchment as it was photographed versus maybe the film that was used to create.
The difference is that they're not, the pictures aren't taken under the same conditions.
The lighting conditions.
I don't think they used film. They were taking digital images when they took the pictures for the website.
Oh, okay. I thought they were.
But they included this as a color scale reference on all of the images that they took.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and so here's what the Leipzig leaves look like, and you can see they're off from the reference far more than the London images are.
So why was it allowed, I wonder, if they knew there was a difference?
I can't answer that question.
And the other question I had was the parchment. You said there was yellow, white, yellow, and purple. Was that based on, I didn't realize they had so many ink colors available, but it makes sense if you had purple, you'd want a light silver, gold.
So you got to distinguish between dyeing the parchment.
Mm-hmm.
So when I showed you the picture of the purple parchment,
right,
this clearly had been dyed.
Right.
And then the inks, the pigments in the inks that were used to write on this parchment were silver and gold color on a purple parchment. So what McGrane is saying is that people are confusing When somebody describes it as snow white parchment, and then they look at the differences in coloring, what he's saying is they're confusing the appearance of the page versus the type of parchment the page was written on.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But did they have that many colors of ink available? I always thought black or.
Yeah, I mean they had that, they did.
Oh, okay.
For sure. Yeah.
That's surprising.
Well, it's, and this codex here, this Gothic codex, is from also like the 4th century. So you have a clear example of a purple parchment with a silver or gold ink on that parchment. And so what McGrain's saying is they've confused all of this. Okay. All right. The second point I want to get into then is a question of, is Simonides trustworthy? Because the entire story here is based upon whether or not Simonides is telling the truth. So I need to find in here where I started talking about Simonides. So just bear with me for a second, because I want to go over this. So the story goes that Simonides, when he sees Tischendorf's codex, he challenges it. Okay, so I'm going to run through this quick. All right. So Tischendorf finds the bulk of the codex in 1859. We're not going to get into the details of how that happens, and that's 315 leaves, and they end up basically in St. Petersburg, Russia. Okay. In 1861, Simonides, the Greek Simonides, is in England working on some document manuscript work for somebody when he sees Tischendorf's, the first extracts of Tischendorf's work of the codex, and he claims that he wrote the codex. Okay, so 1861, July 27, word hits the British press that someone is disputing the antiquity and authenticity of Tischendorf's discovery. So this is a quote from the Literary Gazette from 1861. So this is hashed out in public in the British press over about a 5-year period as this is all being debated in academic paper publications. We understand that in literary circles a rumor prevails that the manuscript now publishing by the Russian government under the direction of Mr. Tischendorf, purporting to be a manuscript of the Bible from the 4th century, is not an ancient manuscript, but is an entirely a modern production written by a gentleman now alive who will shortly take measures to establish his claim as to the authorship. The manuscript is known as Codex Sinaiticus and has attracted a large amount of attention throughout Europe. So the rumor will be proved correct, as we believe it will. The discoveries that will follow must be of the greatest interest to archaeology. So I want you to see here that I'm not like making this up, right? Like this was a real debate that happened publicly in the British press in the 1860s. So this is when word first hits that Simonides, the Greek, is claiming that he is responsible for the codex. Evidence indicates that Simonides expressed his claims to be the author of Codex Sinaiticus privately before word hit the British press in July 1861. J.K. Eliot reports the following quote, Simonides seems to have spoken about the date of Sinaiticus prior to September 1862, insofar as Tregellis knew of the story before then. He spoke of it to J.E. Hodgkin in 1860 and in a letter to Sir Thomas Phillips on August 2, 1861. So then on December 19, 1861, a letter addressed to A. McMillan Hort demonstrates knowledge of Simonides' claim to be the true author of Codex Sinaiticus, and it calls him a liar. So this is a letter that Hort wrote to this A. McMillan guy. Quote, as touching Simonides, I want to examine it carefully for myself. If you can get me the loan of a copy, so much the better. If not, I must buy it. One never knows where to have that fellow. Speaking about Simonides, he undoubtedly has found genuine and valuable manuscripts as well as forgeries. To make the thing more complete, he says he forged Tischendorf's Sinai manuscript, which is the biggest lie of all. So, what's Simonides' reputation here? Not necessarily very good, right? So here's the point now, in September 1862, Simonides publishes a letter in the Guardian newspaper where he officially comes out and now makes a variety of claims as to having been the true creator and author of Codex Sinaiticus. Okay? Number one, so I've just summarized this. Number one, he claims that he created the Codex in 1839 through 1841 on Mount Athos, Greece, as an intended gift for Emperor Nicholas I of Russia. He claims that it was written in an ancient form in capital letters on parchment. It would include the Old and New Testaments, along with Barnabas, Hermas, Clement, Bishop of Rome, Ignatius, Polycarp, Papias, Dionysius, the Areopagite. Benedict prepared the textual exemplars, and Simonides copied them. He allegedly selected an existing, largely blank codex. He removed the ancient front material and other pages that had been, quote, damaged by time and moths. Only Barnabas and Hermas were included because the parchment ran short. So in other words, he ran out of space to include everything. He said that the volume is bound and taken to Constantinople by Simonides and shown to Athamas and Constantinius, Bishop of Sinai, who recommended that it be placed in the Library of Sinai, quoted a letter dated 13 August 1841 from Constantius confirming the volume was placed at Sinai. In 1853, he saw it in the monastery and found it much altered, having an older appearance than it ought to have had. This is what Simonides is claiming. The dedication to Emperor Nicholas, placed at the beginning of the book, had been removed. Does not know how Kishendorf contrived to carry the codex away to St. Petersburg and under the title Codex Sinaiticus. He saw the first facsimiles of Tischendorf, which were put in my hand at Liverpool. I at once recognized my own work, and I immediately told them. So I'm going to stop there. You can read the rest of this on the church's website, okay? So these are the claims that Simonides is making. He's saying that he created the codex in 1840, basically. Okay? And he's got all this backstory now that he's providing for this. All right? Now, in the recently released book, Who Faked the World's Oldest Bible, by Brother Daniels, what he basically does, the bulk of the book, is him taking the details of this story that's being told by Simonides and trying to investigate to try to prove whether or not those details are correct. Okay? And his approach is, if he can prove Simonides to be telling the truth in the details, then we have to accept as truth the entire story of Simonides. So let me read you a few things that he says regarding this. So I'm on page 148 of Who Faked the World's Oldest Bible. So, is the right page? Yeah. So I'm not going to read all this, I'm just going to cut to the chase. Okay? So what he basically is saying is that if he's got four criteria that he's using to determine things, and he's basically saying that people who lie, liars, don't tell the truth about details. So if he can check the details of this report from the Guardian against verifiable things, then he's going to accept that Simonides is telling the truth. Okay? So, I have two comments about that general approach. Number one, I think what Daniel says about that might be true in a general sense, that liars tend to leave out details. However, if you are engaging in a perpetrated known fraud, I would say you want to include details that could be confirmed to hide from view the parts of the story that cannot. As I think about what's going on with Simonides now, years and months later, I am not at all convinced that we should be trusting Simonides. Okay? And let me tell you a few reasons why. So, and this is addressed by McGrane, Kevin McGrane, in his review, starting on page 52. Okay? So, I'm going to read from this, and we'll go from there. Then I have some things to show you before we quit. So, the account of Simonides, so that would be this whole account here that I've summarized on these slides, that was published in The Guardian on September 3rd, 1862, right? The account of Simonides is based on demonstrable falsehoods from the very first sentence of the account. So right away, you need to understand, this is McGrane in total disagreement with Daniels. McGrane is in total disagreement with Daniels, and McGrane wrote this in 2018. Okay? Daniels has not addressed any of the objections that McGrane has raised in the book. Okay? Which for me, it's a problem, because if he wrote on it again, I wanted to see where the stuff was addressed, and it wasn't addressed. In fact, the exact opposite approach was taken where, well, Simonides has to be telling the truth because I can check him on these things. McGrane is saying, no, the whole thing is basically wrong from the beginning. So they both these guys cannot be right, because they're taking very contrary opinions, okay? The account of Simonides is based on demonstrable falsehoods from the very first sentence of the account. Dr. Cooper appears to believe that because some of the details Simonides furnishes can be shown to be true, then he was a trustworthy character. So some of them definitely you can demonstrate to be true. But truth-telling doesn't work like that. It's not enough to produce evidence that Simonides made a few true statements and thereby imply that he was likely telling the truth in his narrative, all the while overlooking incontrovertible evidence aplenty that he was definitely not telling the truth in most aspects of his story. Liars and deceivers seldom make up every single aspect of their story. They use a few known facts as hooks upon which to hang a multitude of fabrications. In this matter, Simonides had form, not merely in his life of fraud with respect to manuscripts, but in waging a campaign of deception through the columns of the newspaper, which began almost immediately after his return from Russia in 1846. In this, we see that Simonides was intent on destroying lives, literally, physically, and reputationally, and we refer firstly to his well-documented and notorious persecution of the American missionary Dr. Johannes King, a godly Calvinist minister responsible for a fledgling evangelical witness in Greece. Writing to the secretary of the Board of Missions, Dr. King reports, quote, so let me just stop there. This guy's an American missionary in Greece. Simonides is a Greek, okay? Simonides is going to attack and destroy this guy because he doesn't want a Protestant witness to Christianity in Greece. Okay? So, we can document all of this stuff, folks. Okay? So this is a report from the Biblical Review of the Congregational Magazine from, the date on this is from 1846, where there's an entrance here, religious intoleration in Greece. Okay? And this entry is about this beginning, this burgeoning controversy in Greece around this missionary, Johannes King. Okay? So, I've highlighted right here just a portion of it. We don't have time to read all of it, but I'm going to include links to all this stuff in the description for this video after the fact on YouTube. He adds, so I'm right here at this blue notation here, okay? I have learned from a source which I deem worthy of confidence that there are about 50 persons combined here who are determined to kill me, that they intend when I should go out to kill me, and that if they could not accomplish this in any other way, they would come and burn my house. So here's an American missionary expressing his concern about his situation in Greece to an American mission board in the middle of the 1840s. Is everybody with me so far? Okay. Simonides was the most prominent and active agent among a powerful group bent on destroying the Protestant cause in Greece, a reputation he publicly boasted about for decades, and was content to spread the most detestable and malicious slanders imaginable about Dr. King, and he perjured himself, claiming to be an eyewitness to late-night orgies in the missionary's home. So he's making the most, this Simonides now making the most sort of outlandish claims about this American missionary to discredit him about what is going on here, okay? So this next bit, This next bit I could not locate, but I'm going to read it to you. This is from the Boston Advisor. No, this is from a... Oh, no, I do have this. This is from a translated report. So here's a document. I pulled this off of academia.com. Constantino Simonides in America. This is about his reputation in the United States as a known liar, forger, and basically criminal, as he's accusing this American missionary of the worst sorts of things in his campaign against him. So, if you look here, here's what I'm quoting from right here, starting with the stories. The stories were perhaps the most outrageous lie that human or diabolical ingenuity have invented. We all who knew Dr. King, and every person of note in the Kingdom of Greece is included in this category, for they all knew that he was a man of a truest virtue, a Puritan of the Puritans. They saw at once the drift and purpose of these detestable falsehoods. Simonides has since confessed the infamous part he acted in the drama of slander and perjury and the persecution of Dr. King. So, who's the ringleader of this group to basically do away with the Protestant witness to the gospel in Greece? It's the very Simonides who two decades later is going to come on the scene and be claiming to have faked or to have created Codex Sinaiticus at Mount Athos, Greece in 1840. Okay? So, a judicial inquiry later proved that this was all a fraud by Simonides, and he was arrested and convicted of forgery. Notwithstanding, Simonides' newspaper campaign sparked off a series of events and incidents, the flames of which Simonides fanned by publishing more and more lies, such that Dr. King and his family came into mortal danger again from mob violence and chose to leave the country for a season. Simonides then took the opportunity to gloat about the success of his campaign in a further newspaper article. Quote, the false apostle, this is Simonides now, the false apostle Johannes King is out of the Greek commonwealth. His nation-corrupting satanic congregation of strange doctrine, already bearing date of 15 years, has now been destroyed. The terrible programs of the great common scandal of religious strange doctrine has been smitten on the land. Of all the foreign holy apostles of various religious and various heresies, unhappily for Greece, heaped together from every corner, no one became more feared and more destructive than the imposter and deceiver Johannes King. So who's the leader of this? Simonides, okay? Not content so he returns home. Johannes King turns home. The diplomatic tensions eventually rose so high that three gunboats from the United States Mediterranean Squadron were dispatched to Athens. So this goes all the way up to the highest levels of the American government, this controversy surrounding Simonides and this American missionary, that the American government dispatches ships, warships, to the area because the tensions have risen to this level. From the United States Mediterranean Squadron were dispatched to Athens. The President of the United States, Franklin Pierce, became personally involved, and the matter was referred by him to the U.S. Congress, and appears in the official record with copious references to Simonides and translations of his newspaper articles. These documents run to hundreds of pages, and the correspondence from George Perkins Marsh, the United States Minister Resident in the Ottoman Empire, to the U.S. Secretary of State Daniel Webster, well capture the role Simonides was playing in concert with the enemies of the gospel. So now we're going to quote from the Congressional Record. So this is from the report of... Whoops, that's the wrong document. Hold on. This one, I believe. Yeah. So this is the Senate documents. published records of the Senate documents of the United States Congress. Wednesday, so I have it in blue there, Wednesday the 28th of July, an article appeared in The Age, one of the first newspapers in Athens, called The Orgies, and signed by Simonides, stating that he was present at Mr. King's house on certain nights when these orgies were performed by Mr. King, and that he, Simonides, had been an eyewitness of the whole and was ready to be examined on the subject by any court of justice. Simonides then proceeded to describe with great particularity these orgies, which he says he witnessed, giving the day and the hour when performed and the exact number of persons present. So he's making all this up as a smear campaign to end what's going on here with this American missionary, and now the American government is involved in this. Okay? The same document, gotta find it here, just give me a second. So same document, records this a few pages later. In 1847, a swindler named Simonides, notorious throughout Turkey, Russia, and Greece as an imposter, counterfeiter, and cheat, published in the columns of The Age a description of certain pretended orgies which he had witnessed at Dr. King's house as religious ceremonies performed by him. Simonides was well known as a special protege, favorite, and instrument of the clerical party. His statements were monstrously and palpably false, and Dr. King was in no small danger of personal violence in consequence of the particular incitement with which these discourses and comments of his enemies upon them produced, and he goes on. Okay? So, should we trust Simonides? I'm saying, unless somebody can answer this stuff, I don't believe you can take anything Simonides says with a grain of salt. You cannot take it at face value, even if there are some things he says that could be checked out, because he's already established himself as a person of extremely ill repute and reputation. In the footnotes on page 55, McGrain says the following. Indeed, Simonides continued to boast of his actions in this matter. References to his newspaper libels being repeated in Stewart's biographical memoir, 1859. This was in England at the start of the Simonides affair over Codex Sinaiticus. So not something in the past that he was ashamed of and wished to be forgotten. He was still glorying in his lies and the powerful effects of them when all of this hit the British press. Okay? So, I'm going to go to page 127 and then I'll take any questions. What I'm saying to you is, the whole story about whether or not this is a 19th century forgery is based upon the witness of Simonides. And Simonides, it seems to me, has demonstrated himself to be somebody that nobody should what? Believe. Okay? So, page 127 of McGrain's review. Bottom paragraph. Dr. Cooper is prepared to set aside all the well-attested evidence of Simonides' life of deception. However, Simonides' diabolical deception in inventing and disseminating lies about the godly minister of the gospel, Johannes King, and Simonides' involvement in genuine conspiracies against the church cannot be set aside, since they are not matters of opinion or of scholarly judgment, but absolute certainties. Simonides freely chose to throw in his lot with the enemies of the gospel and became a vicious agent to attack the Church of Christ with devilish lies. His wicked deceptions were known to Presbyterian and congregational churches and missionary organizations in the United States and the United Kingdom from 1846, and the executive and legislature of the United States in the early 1850s. And Simonides was still boasting about his persecutions and murderous intents during his time in England from the late 1850s. His claims to have discovered the original autographs of the New Testament, which were outright forgeries by him, and his claim to have written Codex Sinaiticus, which, now here's the point. which drew attention away from its heterodox origins and unfortunately furthered its acceptance, fit into a course of conduct in attacking the church. So what is McGrane saying? McGrane is saying, look, if Simonides had not gone to the press and made a big deal about this, the attention would not have been on, is it really as old, but it would have been on the contents of the document and are they really orthodox? You following that? Okay? So, as J.K. Eliot remarks himself, a textual scholar, ironically, had it not been for Simonides, many scholars, especially in England, may not have been so interested in Simonides or taken much notice of the manuscripts. You following that? Dr. Cooper suggests that the reason why critics gave Simonides such a hard time over his claim that he wrote Codex Sinaiticus was that they were involved in a conspiracy against the Bible and thus conspired to call him a forger to discredit him. What this ignores is that Simonides had been continually exposed as a forger and a liar for 14 years before he started spreading his narrative in the 1860s about writing the Codex. Notices had gone out in the 1840s and 1850s to universities, museums, and libraries all over Europe, warning them to beware of Simonides. During those years, the vast majority of documents rejected as forgeries were non-religious classical works, and thus his longtime reputation as a forger was until 1860 unrelated to biblical material. Okay? Now, any questions about all that? I know some of you might be bored. I'm sorry. I have to update people on where I'm at with things. Okay? Because I've spent time teaching this, and I'm saying that I'm walking back from this until somebody can demonstrate. If somebody can take what McGrane has said and factually disprove it, I'd be willing to listen. But at this point, I see all of the objections totally unanswered and not dealt with. Okay? So if the whole thing, if the authenticity of the Codex hangs largely on the color issues and on whether Simonides is telling the truth, I'm not willing to say that it's a 19th century forgery because I don't think there's sufficient evidence for that to be the case. That does not mean, therefore, that I accept it as a viable witness to the preserved Word of God, because I don't, and I never did, even before I started reading all this stuff. All right, so any questions or comments?
Well, if you discard everything about Simonides and the color issue, there's still a lot of evidence that it was a forgery. Not an authentic, even if it was old.
Oh, if it was old, it's a corrupt manuscript, right? Without a doubt. Without a doubt, it's a corrupt manuscript. It's just what's happening now is a lot of defenders of the King James and the traditional text of the Textus Receptus, they see this as a big way to sort of score points in the debate. And I'm just no longer convinced that it is that based upon the argument that it's a ancient, based upon the argument that it's a 19th century forgery.
Right.
So, no, I agree with you, Mike. It's not a good manuscript regardless of the age. So I want to read, though, if nobody else has anything, I want to kind of read where McGrane ultimately falls on this, because I think, now, Uspensky, the Russian Uspensky, who saw the Codex twice and took some fragments back to Russia with him, he said that the thing was a 6th century manuscript, so that would have been from when? The 500s. That was copied from a 4th century exemplar from the 300s. But he says the best he can do is to say that it was a what? a 6th century copy of a 4th century document. Now, here's what my grain says to end this. Codex Sinaiticus is not a 19th century forgery. And to assert that it is, or that Codex Vaticanus was tampered with in the 19th century, flies in the face of the facts that can be established. However, the alternative of a 4th century production of Codex Sinaiticus does not follow from rejection of Cooper's thesis. So in other words, if you reject this idea that it's a 19th century forgery, it does not automatically mean then that you are bound to the only other option, that it's a genuine 4th century manuscript. Okay? So, McGrane is acknowledging this. Important scholars have considered it to be the production of a 5th or 6th century, 4th century exemplar, which is what I just said here. Okay? But whether it's a 6th century copy of a 4th century edition or an edition made in the 4th century, there is an important 4th century component in a time when the church was fighting for its life against the Arian controversies, from which there is ample testimony of the corruption of the scriptures by the Arians. To attribute the existence of Codex Sinaiticus or Codex Vaticanus to much later popish plots blunts the argument that needs to be made against it because it misdirects the fire. So he's saying when you do this, you are undercutting the real argument and why the document really matters in the debate between the critical text and the traditional text. Okay? He says, to attribute the existence of Codex Sinaiticus or Vaticanus to much later popish plots blunts the argument that needs to be made against them because it misdirects the fire. John Bergen's incisive argument, for example, proceeded from the premise that these codices were genuinely ancient, but that the readings of the great uncials could not be the text that was received by the church, i.e., the Textus Receptus. There was one Catholic Church, but many heretics working, and when he says Catholic Church, I'm not sure if he means like the Roman Catholic Church or just the Universal Church. It's unclear, but there was one Catholic Church, but many heretics working in different places who could not coordinate their corruptions. Many of the autographs were still in existence in the second century, and Irenaeus and Tertullian attest, and the Catholic Church could check their copies against those, whereas the various Gnostic cults in their day could not. Accordingly, the ancient copies that have been tampered with differed widely among themselves and continued to degenerate. Uspensky, who, as we have seen, rediscovered the Sinaitic New Testament in 1845, affirmed that Sinaiticus was a 4th century text. He did not doubt that the work was genuinely ancient and thus valuable as a historical artifact, yet he saw that it was suffused, is the word, with Arianism. So in other words, he identified that the thing is corrupt, even though it was old. Okay? There are indeed many anomalies and unanswered questions concerning the dating and provenance of Codex Sinaiticus, and museums would do the public a great service if they would address themselves to them. But quite apart from its dating and provenance or any conspiracy attending to it, the Codex stands or falls on its own merits or dismerits, and in that regard, it must be judged as a hopeless witness to the text of the New Testament. So is McGrane accepting it as a witness or is he rejecting it as a witness? He's rejecting it as a witness on the basis of corrupt Arian readings. So McGrane is not, therefore, taking up the mantle of the critical text in modern versions. What he's essentially arguing is poor scholarship on the part of some of the defenders of the 19th century forgery conspiracy are blunting the issue and therefore confusing the real issue with the Codex and therefore obscuring its real, usefulness or so, something along those lines. So I'm going to continue to keep everything on the church website that I've done on this, even the stuff that I don't want, that I at this time would say I'm not necessarily sure I agree with it anymore. because I want to keep a full log of everything I've said about this so that people can see that I've changed my mind on the matter in the light of evidence. And let me just say again, because this is going to be watched by people who believe that Daniels and Sorensen and Cooper are accurate in telling the story the way it really is. It doesn't matter if you can... what makes somebody a liar, a good liar, is that they have enough truth in their lie that it obscures the parts of the story that aren't what? That aren't true. And if there's interest in this, I would consider possibly doing one more of these in a few weeks, talking about other elements of the story that Simonides told that are of very questionable authenticity. Okay? So, any questions or comments? The other people involved in this, you know, I love Brother Daniels. I've talked to him personally. I don't understand why he wouldn't have addressed these major and significant issues that are raised to the thesis by McGrane and others. But anyway, any other questions from those of you that are here? Now that you're all sufficiently bored and... All right. What's that? Yeah, I mean, Simonides, if he had a established reputation as a truth teller previous to this, maybe we would have something. But I mean, when you have even up into the highest levels of the American government, people aware of him and dispatching American warships to Athens because of a controversy that he's created with an American missionary, I mean. And then he's bragging about it in Britain in the late 1850s, right on the eve of the controversy erupting in the British papers. That to me is a problem. And somebody who's going to say that it is a 19th century forgery needs to address the objections that are raised by McGrane and others. All right. If there are no questions.
So are you saying that this Kodak Sinai had issues even before him?
Oh, yeah. And I probably need to do another thing because there was a documented earthquake at Mount Sinai in 1839. Part of one of the walls fell down. Okay? Then they rebuilt, but in 1975, somebody was excavating and they found behind this wall some extra parchment pieces of Codex Sinaiticus, which had been buried behind the wall with that in that earthquake in 1839, which would clearly place the manuscript, and McGrane talks about this in his review, which would clearly place the manuscript at Mount Sinai before Simonides wrote it, allegedly, in 1840. But again, that's a point that is not addressed. And I want to hear an explanation for it that makes sense. I don't want some nonsensical thing. It needs to make sense and be able to be verified by, documentation. Anyway, we got to quit. I'm going to pick.